First, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to talk about this project. This project is part of my PhD project, which I've been pursuing the last 4 years under the supervision of Renate Loll. Let me first explain to you what I will be talking about. So causal dynamical triangulations, they are a proposal to define a path integral of gravity in a non-perturbative fashion. The path integral of gravity becomes a sum over triangulation because we impose a discretization of space-time and also of the action. Now, these individual triangulations, they come with a special substructure. They become with a foliation, with a preferred foliation. And in this talk, I would like to discuss the question whether this foliation is really necessary to define dynamic triangulation model, which has good physical properties such as CDT. And I will introduce such a model to you in the following, let's say, an hour. Now about the structure of this talk. I will first give you a compact review of CDT. And afterwards, I will then move on to introduce the new model to you, which we have given the name, locally causal dynamical triangulations. And I will start in 1 plus 1 dimension, which is, of course, much simpler. And then I will move on to 2 plus 1 dimensions. After this theoretical part, I will then move on to numerical results, which we have performed using simulations. And we have performed the simulations also in 2 plus 1 dimensions. After presenting these results, I will then conclude and summarize and also discuss possible future research in this topic. Now, here's also a pointer to the recent article which we have put on the archive just about a week ago about this topic, and the second article is in preparation. And so let's start with the first part of the talk about introduction of causal dynamic triangulation. Now, this idea, which is implemented by CDT, namely to superimpose curved spacetimes, is mathematically expressed as a pure gravity path integral. And this expression here, it's important to notice, this is really a formal expression. So in order to make sense of it, you have to really regularize it. And a particular way of regularizing it is by introducing a simplicial complex. This is what we do in the dynamic triangulation approach. And this kind of regularization has a nice feature that it is a coordinate-free approach. And this sum, I mean, after discretization, this integral becomes a sum, is an effectively over equivalence class of metrics. And notice also in this path integral here, we see the action, which of course is Einstein, well, it's the Einstein-Hilbert action. And now the question here about this expression is here. What's this integral of geometries, or what's in the discrete case, what's the sum over which geometry should we sum? And there are several proposals, and one of them is the causal dynamic triangulations. And here, the individual triangulation have this particular structure, namely this foliation, which I can illustrate here in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So you see here, I mean, important is also to notice, I have here a color code. So there are links here, and the links can be space-like and time-like. So the space-like links, they're in blue, and the time-like links are in red. And I will use this code throughout the whole presentation. Here you see a bunch of spatial triangles, which here form a disk, and you can imagine that the disk goes on and forms such a slice. And here on the top, there's another spatial disk, which is then continued to a spatial slice. And between these slices, we have these tetrahedra, which interpolate between them. So these triangulations have this foliated structure with the leaves of the foliation. And one nice thing about the foliation is that it provides a time variable. So we can simply label these slices. We can say the first one is a time t equals 0, next is time equal 1, and 2, and 3. So here's time t and t plus 1. This is very nice to have when we have a foliation. We have this time variable. Now, another thing, of course, another important thing is the action. And in order to use the action in our approach, we have to first discretize it. But we also have to impose a weak rotation. And that's because we want to do simulations. And that's why it's necessary to have weak rotation. Otherwise, you cannot use Monte Carlo simulations. Now, after doing discretization and weak rotation, one can rewrite the action in a particularly simple form, shown here. And these n variables here, they just count these various objects like vertices, like simplices. And the other objects are couplings. Here's one, the kappa naught, the delta, and the kappa 4. And these couplings are related to those that you know. So this here is the bare gravitational coupling. Here's the bare cosmological coupling. But there's also a third coupling here. And this one is called asymmetry parameter. And how it comes about is the following. So we have these space-like and time-like links. They have lengths. And these square lengths are fixed. This means all the space-like links have the same length. All the time-like links have all the same length. But relatively speaking, they can have different lengths. And we can express this using this relation here. And the proportionality factor is precisely this alpha. And because we evaluate the action on such a triangulation, alpha then enters into the action. So it's not a coupling which we just ad hoc enter into the action, but it comes implicitly in by evaluating the action. That's important to note. So after performing this discretization of space-time and also of the action, this original path integral here then gets converted into an object which is basically a partition function. And this partition function is, of course, a nice property. We can explore it using simulations. So here, this is the sum of triangulations. We have here the action. And this is the discretized form. It's the Regi action, yes? No, I would not say so. Well, we don't know precisely because we cannot do it in an analytic way. I mean, it's not the same kind of calculation like in QFT. This weak rotation that we have is in this sense different that we do not have a time coordinate in the usual sense. Yeah, it's not really just a time coordinate. It's just that we take the link lengths. I mean, the link lengths of the time-like links. The length of the time-like links, then we rotate these lengths. And this is then our weak rotation. That's why it's a bit of a different approach than conventionally in quantum field theory.
So could you consider this an analytic rotation in alpha?
It is. It is. Yes. Yes. Precisely. Yeah. Okay, so we have now this partition function. And once we have this, we can start evaluating observables numerically. And we have to do it simply because in higher dimensions, we cannot do analytical calculations, or almost none. And that's why from 2 plus 1 and 3 plus 1 dimension, we use Monte Carlo simulation to evaluate observables. And one important thing we can observe is the phase structure of CDT. And here's an illustration of the phase structure that we have measured in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And what we find is that there are three types of geometries, or three phases of geometries. And we've analyzed all of them over time. And one has found that we've labeled them A, B, and C, as you see. And these two, A and B, have shown to be to have unphysical features, and that's why they are of less importance for us. But then these geometries here in phase C have shown to have very nice physical properties. And I will summarize them on the next page. So what we have found in this phase is if you, for example, look at the spectral dimension, that at long distances, it's really four-dimensional. This is really nice. But on the other hand, we also have a prediction for short dimensions that we have this dimensional reduction to two dimensions, approximately two dimensions. Or then there is also another dimension variable, the dimension observable, the Hausdorff dimension, which also turns out to be four. at large distances. So it's a very nice result. And one can also analyze the volume profile. So if I can show you on the previous slide again. So these geometries here, you can imagine that these are basically just the volume distribution in function of time. So there is time like this. And you have here the distribution of spatial volume. And the graphic is just has been made by rotating it. That's just a surface of revolution. So this volume profile, and in fact the averaged volume profile, has been analyzed. And it has been shown to be fitted by a Euclidean de Sitter spacetime, which was a very important result for causal dynamic triangulations. And another important result concerns phase transitions. And again, on this illustration, we see that we have three phases, and they're separated, of course, by phase transitions. And here is the one between the A and the C phase, and here's the other. And we have analyzed them a few years ago, and we have found that this transition here is first order, while this one is second order. And having a second order transition is very important if you want to find the continuum limit of the theory, because then there could be potential ultraviolet fixed points there, where you can really attempt to send the cutoff, the lattice cutoff to zero, yes? Yes. So we have compact spatial slices, typically sphere topology. I mean, in 3 plus 1 dimension, it's a 3-sphere. And in time direction, we have a technical simplicity that we use periodic time, periodic conditions in time, so that we basically have time compactified on a circle. But that's just a technical tool. I say it again. Here? Do you mean here? Now you have to imagine this is the weak rotator setting here, the Euclidean setting. Yeah, that's basically just a sphere. This Euclidean de Sitter is basically the sphere, or the D sphere, if you go to higher dimensions. Yeah, so the spatial slices are just normal D spheres. Okay? So we've seen that causal dynamic triangulation has had very nice successes. And now, so CDT has been introduced after the Euclidean dynamic triangulation have been studied before. And an essential new ingredient of CDT was this foliated structure. And now one can ask the interesting question, is it really necessary to have this foliated structure and to have these nice physical properties, which we've just seen before? And to address this question, we just have to define a model which does, where the triangulations do not have this preferred foliation. And in the following, I will just introduce such a model to you, which we call the locally causal dynamical triangulations. Now, the strategy how to do this is following. We start first to choose the building blocks. And in a 1 plus 1 dimensions, these will be triangles. And afterwards, after having chosen the building blocks, we need to impose condition. And the important condition which we will impose is local causality. That means that light cones are well defined throughout the whole triangulation. Next, we choose a suitable action, and we choose the Regi action. And in order to explore the model using the simulations, we need to define Monte Carlo moves. And then after we have defined Monte Carlo move, we also need to develop a software. And that's what we did. We developed a simulation software to analyze the model in 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1 dimensions. And now let's start with the theory of the model first in 1 plus 1 dimension, which is, of course, simpler than the higher dimensional case. Let us first choose the building blocks. Now, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, we want to have triangles. And as I said before, the length of the space-like links are fixed. The length of the time-like links are also fixed. And under this condition, there's exactly four triangles which you can actually draw using two colors. These are these four triangles. But now, we want to have Lorentzian triangles. The question is, which one of those are Lorentzian? Turns out that this one is a Euclidean triangle, which is not surprising, of course, because there's all space-like links here. And this one has two time-like directions, so these are not suitable. But then it turns out that there are two Lorentzian triangles, these two here. And this one here was used in CDT. That was the only triangle which was used in CDT. But there is a second one. This means using this second triangle, you can build, of course, more general triangulations than these foliated ones which you know from CDT. Yeah, but not equilateral. Yeah, that's what I said before. So the lengths are fixed of all the space length links, and those of time links are also fixed. And then you cannot have, otherwise you're right, of course. Yes. Okay, so we have these two triangles. But then if we would just arbitrarily glue these together, we would not get a causal triangulation. So how do we analyze this? So the problems that we can get are at vertices. And that's why we need to know the precise structure of the light cones at the vertices. And here in this illustration, I have inserted light-like lines. These are the green ones. And it's easy to compute where they are. So it's easy to see that here are none. But here are light-like lines, and here as well. And so now these pictures are very useful, because in the following, we will now glue these triangles together. And then we can easily see when have we a causal triangulation and when are we not a causal triangulation. Let's have a look at these examples. So we have here all these triangles of both types. And here you see these light-like lines, which I've shown before. And now if you, for example, analyze the surrounding, let's look at the center vertex and just walk around. And you see you intersect light cone twice. So this is not a well-defined light cone, of course, because we know that light cone looks different. We will see there a good example afterwards. Here's another example. There's another gluing of triangles. And if you walk here around the vertex, you will intersect light cone six times. That's also not a valid light cone. And from here, we already know what we have to require. So the primary condition here is we have to require at every vertex, when we go around, we have to intersect the light cone precisely four times. Yes?
Can you just say more about this? Because it's not your obvious why the Lorentz is violated on the two on the left and the one on the right. Can you
trace? Well, we know the topology of the light cone in one plus one dimension. It's just a cross. So it's, well, it's just.
So can you draw pictures to make it obvious that
Well, so if you have just the normal Minkowski, let's see. If you have a Minkowski diagram with time and space like this, then the light cones are like this. And that's the topology which you have to have in order to have a valid Minkowski light cone. And this here is certainly not of this topology. Yeah, for example, here, well, so the standard light cone has this future sector over here. So this is the future and the past sector here. So that all the time-like curves, they go like this or here. Oops. And if you have something like here, this is then, oh, this is not, this is blue. And this is here a space-like curve. But that's a canonical picture. And that's what we want to have also as well in the triangulation.
So I can sort of imagine that it might be the case. But is it easy to actually demonstrate that there's no backward light cone in that structure?
Yes, one can explicitly show this. That's true. Well, it essentially follows by the fact that all these triangles are flat. That's basically the essential ingredient. So the curvature lives at the vertex. So inside the triangles, there is no curvature at all. It's flat. then one can easily show that there is no light cone here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you do, so there are little green lines inside the bottom right, the bottom triangle, but they don't come off. They always come from the intersection of the red and the blue line. They always come from a intersection of the red and blue line. Okay, so that's the step I was missing. I'm sorry, I know it's obvious to you, but.
No, this could, yeah, it's a stupid little Minkowski.
Okay. Well, so the problem, of course, is that we are in a Euclidean setting, in a weak rotator setting, and of course, our horizon principle disappear if you go to the Euclidean setting. So it's pretty hard to actually detect, for example, a black hole, and there's not much work has been done to this. Yes, it's your work, yes, precisely. Yes, precisely. Okay, any further questions? Okay, so we've talked about the local causality condition that we require that the light cone has the correct topology. And let's just now talk about the flow of time. So how can we understand the flow of time with these triangles? And we can understand it by time orienting a triangle like shown in this picture. So we have, for example, here a space-like link, and then we know that time flows either in this direction or in this. That's basically just a choice of time orientation. And here we have just made a choice, and we say time flows like this, and then it flows also in this direction and like this. So you can choose one of these two time orientations, and you can do it for both triangles. And once you have time oriented two triangles, then you can start gluing these triangles together, and then you can continue this flow of time. And this looks like shown here, where you see a bunch of these triangles, and if you go from one triangle to the other, it's always uniquely defined, the time orientation, because you have always this shared link, and it has to be consistent. So you can continue the time orientation. So the question is, how far can you continue it? Locally, you can always do it if local causality holds, but the question is, can you do it globally as well? And that's a bit the question. I mean, it depends on topology. So for some topologies, for example, if you would use a Möbius strip, then it's clear that you cannot continue the time orientation in a consistent fashion. And for this reason, we have added the requirement that we always can do it. So we require our triangulations to always be such that we can continue the time orientation, such that we have a globally well-defined flow of time. This is. Now, this is, you mean whether whether they're equivalent?
Yeah.
So, well, for example, of course, if you choose a topology like the Möbius strip, then you can have.
So, is this local time orientation equivalent to the local causality? Or
is yeah, if local causality holds, then you can always time orient like this. That's true. If we, and this is something I haven't looked at, if you would just require. Well, I would say it should, but I have not really proven such a thing.
I mean, can you show that in the examples where you violate the two things, you cannot never put a time orientation?
Well, I can. Well, in the examples before, I have indeed attempted to put a time orientation. It was not possible for these examples. But that, of course, doesn't say it's never possible. But here, it's really impossible. That's true. Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's of course not so obvious. I mean, you have to start drawing. I mean,
yeah, I think it immediately to that 10 2 and it was the light on was not really fine, but the time of the time
The next one?
Yeah.
Here?
No, what is it? Yeah.
Ah, here.
That one.
Yeah?
That's like the triangle, I don't know.
What do you mean?
Like on the right?
Yeah?
A bit up? Yeah, that one. Imagine that you exchange the blue edge by the red one above it.
I haven't.
So. Well, anyway. Instead of having blue, red, if we go anti-clockwise, blue, red, imagine having blue, red.
So, okay, I don't understand.
Blue, red, blue. So you start this one
blue,
the next one
red, and then
the next one blue.
So again, so this one blue, and then what do we do?
Next one,
this one. So what are you saying?
Red.
This one should be red. I mean, you're saying you want to recolor it or what?
No, Mercedes wants to define an example which violates.
Okay. So blue, then red,
and then blue.
And then blue.
That would violate.
Yeah, because the types of links have to change also four times. Because you see here,
right,
there's...
So this is an example, is that the same right? This is an example that violates causality but has a time orientation.
Yeah, I think so.
Ah. Well, that has to be shown, of course. Well, I would be interested in trying it out, in fact. So we can look at it afterwards. Okay? Yeah, sure, that's true. Okay, so let's proceed on. So how does such dimension actually look like? Here's an example, which is can illustrate the differences to CDT. So first of all, of course, one should mention that CDT triangulations are a subset of this larger ensemble of triangulations. Therefore, you still have these structures which you know from CDT, such as here, these which we call the thick slices, which are these kind of sandwich structures between two spatial slices. So they're still there. But now we can also have other things. For example, here, I've marked this in light blue, is a structure which we call a bubble. And the special thing about it is that it is a structure which is completely enclosed by space-like links, like here. And you also see here that the spatial slices, they branch out. This is, of course, clear because of the new triangle, because this here is one of the new triangles. And something else which, for example, can happen if you have, for example, if you start out with a CDT thick slice, and then you just squish these two slices together at some point, and you can create something like which we call a pinching, such that the spatial slice, they meet in a point. There's also a new structure which is not possible in CDT. So this is an example for illustration purposes. I can give you an example how such a triangulation can look like. So that was the 1+1 dimensional case. So after this introduction, let's go to 2+1 dimensions. So why not just go to 3+1? So first of all, every new model comes with its own challenges, and it's good to study them in an easier setting. And another thing is also that writing the simulation software is really hard in this model. So in order to prepare, for example, writing a software for 3+1 dimensions, it's good to have a working one for 2+1 dimensions. And another reason to use 2+1 is also because from CDT we know that the results that we have in 2+1, they scale pretty well, actually, to 3+1 dimensions. So one can get a pretty good hint about what we could expect in 3+1 dimensions in this case. So let's have a look at the 2+1 dimensional case, and we will just proceed in a similar way as before. Yes? Yeah, it would be interesting, but now we are currently not in a position to really show this because we would need more fine-grained observers to do this. So far, the 2 plus 1 and the 3 plus 1 case look pretty similar. So that's why we do not. Yeah, of course, yeah. True. Of course. Well, the BC we don't have actually, so that's it. Okay, so let's have a look at the 2 plus 1 dimensional case. And we will just proceed in a similar way by first looking at the building blocks. So here we are talking about tetrahedra. And first, the question is, how many tetrahedra can you draw with two colors? And you can draw 11 of them. And it turns out, and if you calculate the metric inside these tetrahedra, there's four of them. Actually, depending on the asymmetry parameter, there's a fifth one, which is Lorentzian. So four of them are Lorentzian unconditionally. And this one is a bit special because it's Lorentzian if the symmetry parameter is smaller than 1, and otherwise it's not Lorentzian. So this means that we can just, for example, if we want to study the model, which also includes the alpha, which are greater than 1, we just have to leave out this tetrahedron. That's what we did. So we work with the four yellow tetrahedron. And please note that two of them are found in CDT, and two of them are new. So the local causality condition, which we have seen in 1 plus 1 dimension, can be generalized. And we have to, for this, before the local causality condition was at vertices, and now the analogous condition is at the space-like links. So we have here a space-like link. And now if we look here, the same space-like link, then we have a bunch of tetrahedra around. And we can look at the plane which is orthogonal to the space-like link. And this plane is, of course, 1 plus 1 dimensional, shown here. And then we can just use the causality condition in 1 plus 1 dimension to define 1 for 2 plus 1 dimensions. And for time-like links, we do not have a causality condition because the plane is Euclidean. So the time orientation of tetrahedra is something which works pretty similar like for the triangles shown here in the picture. And again, we also require that we can really continue this time orientation globally. Let's talk about the action. So we work with the Einstein-Hilbert action, and the discretized version of it is the Regi action. So the Regi action after weak rotation can be written in such a form, which is these five terms. And again, we have these couplings which depend on the bare Newton constant, the bare cosmological constant, and the symmetry parameter. So the whole space here of actions is five-dimensional. And this is actually larger than the space of Regi action. So this is a new feature here. Because in CDT, it was the case that the space of all linear actions had the same dimension like the space of the Regi actions. Now we also have to choose, yes? That's difficult to say what it means in the continuum, in fact, because it's really defined on the microscopic level, on the regularized level. That's why it's hard to say what if there's any meaning to it in the continuum. Yeah. No. A choice of what? Well, we see dynamically that it's just not simply a choice of units, because we see in CDT that really, depending on alpha, you have different phases. You have even a phase transition which you can cross if you vary alpha. So it's very non-trivial. Okay, let's talk about topology. So in CDT, we usually use a topology of this product form. So this is the spatial topology here, typically these spheres. And then we typically compactify time to a circle. This is just due to technical reasons. But now, in this case, we actually have problems with this. And then we decided to really go to the actual three-sphere spacetime topology in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So we can implement this by putting a source and a sink of time at the poles of the topology. And of course, a source and sink of Euclidean time. So we are in a weak-rotated setting. And this is also motivated from CDT, because CDT originally has this topology, but dynamically we find then that the topology actually wants to change to three-sphere, because we observe this stalk. And then this is kind of an indication that topology wants actually to be the three-sphere. And that's why we are motivated also to use it here. And that's the choice which we made, the three-sphere as the topology. We also need a weak rotation, of course. And we can, so there's a constraint in CDT on this imagery parameter. So only if this constraint is satisfied, then the weak rotation actually works. And for the new model, we had to repeat the calculation. And then we have found a stricter bound on the symmetry parameter. So let us explore the phase diagram of this model. And this weak rotation bound is here illustrated. Here is one bound, and here is the other. And the axis here, so here is an axis which we call k. And this k is just proportional to the inverse bare Newton coupling. And the other axis is just the asymmetry parameter. So we're going to explore this space, but we can only explore part of it, because there's also technical issues here which prevented us from looking at here. But we will have a look at this green region, and particularly we will have a look at this axis here. So the k-axis and the alpha axis here upstairs. So in the following, we will discuss numerical simulations which we have done precisely on these axes. So let's first count tetrahedra. So as you've seen before, we have four Lorentzian tetrahedra. We have two of them are CDT. They are found in CDT, and two are new. So here we have measured the number of tetrahedra in function of the k coupling. So that was the horizontal axis on the phase diagram. The green curves, they are the CDT tetrahedra, and the red curves are the new tetrahedra. And this plot here basically illustrates that there is a phase transition here. And this phase transition is basically the one you would expect, because we had a similar phase transition in the Euclidean dynamic triangulation, and we also have one in CDT. There was always some phase transition somewhere on this axis of the inverse Newton coupling, and it is still there. So this is just a confirmation. Now, more interesting is if we look at tetrahedron counts on the alpha axis. And here is a part of the part which is technically accessible to us. So we have measured the tetrahedron count. Again, the green ones, the CDT tetrahedra, and the other one are the new tetrahedron. And now, as you move to this phase boundary here, you see that the new tetrahedron, they go away. They go to zero. What this means is that these triangulations here have only tetrahedron, which we have also in CDT. And this means the triangulations, they are foliated. So that means we have here a corner in the phase diagram where actual CDT emerges. This is already a very nice result. Now, let's proceed. We want to have, yes? We don't know yet, actually.
But at least from here, there's one phase transition related to the change of the transition.
Yeah.
But no phase transition related.
Well, we don't know whether there's no phase transition, because we have only a part of the phase diagram analyzed. There could be another.
We don't see one.
Yeah, not yet, maybe.
So in this sense, one could say that until now, alpha is just a parameter in the relation between the time or whatever we call it.
Well, but exactly if you are in a region where the dynamics is close to CDT, then if you say it is important in CDT, then it should be equally important also here in this case.
But I'm exactly saying that the alpha parameter should not be important in CDT.
Yeah.
And here it's not
Yeah, there, of course, but there is also an easy argument why it's not important, because we do not have enough degrees of freedom for it. Here the situation is a bit different.
Well, I'm just trying to answer that. That it suits you. I'll put the parameter of the node is to the port.
Yes.
That's not the case for the port, but it seems to be maybe the case for the stream. That's all I want.
No, it remains to be seen, yes. Okay. Now we want to study a bit more refined observable. Now, for example, if we want to study an observable like the volume profile in CDT, then we first face the problem that in CDT we have a simple time coordinate. And the time coordinate is just provided by the foliation. But now, in this model, this foliation is not there in general. So how do we define a time coordinate? So that was one of our tasks, to define such a time coordinate. We have played with different definitions, and we finally figured out one of them which works very well. So what we do is, in the triangulation, for every vertex, we measure the average distance to the poles of our three-sphere, and then we calculate the difference of these. So this is a variable which resembles the theta coordinate on the sphere. So this gives us a time coordinate which we can use to define observables, and then we can compare with CDT. And of course, it is important that such a time variable is actually compatible with CDT when we really use foliated triangulations. And this is indeed the case. Let's just draw here a three sphere, I mean. Sketch. You have to scale it up by one dimension, of course. So we use the three-sphere topology. We have here the north pole and here the south pole. And so if you have here a vertex, now let's take the red one here. So there's plenty of time like world lines here going from here to the north pole. So we can measure the length of all these time-like world lines which go to the north poles and calculate the average of it. We can also, let's make here, these are future-oriented time-like world lines. And we can do the same here in backward direction. Indeed, yes. Precisely. And then we calculate the average distance from the vertex to the north pole. And this is then some quantity, let's say like this. And then we subtract the quantity which we have here. So here the one distance and here the other distance. Then we calculate the difference that it means. But if you get zero, that means you are closest to the equator of the sphere. And if the value becomes larger, then you go away from the equator. So this is why it is like a theta coordinate if you have polar coordinates on the sphere. So let's have a look at an observable which is of qualitative kind and which helps us to really see what kind of geometries that are provided by the simulation. So if we have a time coordinate at a vertex, we can easily also assign a time coordinate to a tetrahedron. We can simply calculate an average. Once we have a time coordinate for a tetrahedron, we can make a histogram. So we can simply count how many tetrahedron are found in some time interval, and then we can make a plot of this histogram. So first of all, how does this look like in the case of a strictly foliated triangulation that we have in CDT? So there, we have a structure like this here. We have what we see here are basically is a superposition of two curves. And this is just reflecting an internal substructure that is found in CDT. I have here shown a zoom in into the structure here. So this is now basically a signature of a strictly foliated triangulation. And now it's interesting to see what happens if we move away from the location in the phase diagram where we have these CDT-like triangulations. So how does this look like if we move away? So I've made three examples, and maybe it is a good idea to just sketch again the phase diagram over there for your orientation. So we have here, well, yeah, let's make it like this. Again, the K axis, which is proportional to the inverse Newton coupling. We have here the alpha axis. Here is this boundary before weak rotation is 1/2. So here, let's make it like this. Here is the CDT corner. This means in this region here, the triangulations are almost foliated. And what we now do is we move away from the CDT corner downwards towards this point here. So what we see here on the plot, this is again the same as before. This is the strictly foliated triangulation. As we move away towards minus 0.7, then we see that there is some change in the triangulation. And what we see here is that there is a new kind of distribution here at the bottom. One can also understand them as follows. So if you have the CDT triangulation, and this is fixed, then you have this layering structure. So now in the new model, just imagine you can insert here objects of this kind, for example. And here again, maybe something like this. This means that these thin slices, you see that these slices here have basically a thickness of zero, while here they acquire a non-trivial thickness here, and this is reflected here. So one can interpret these, that these slices in CDT become more complicated. And as one proceeds towards here in downward direction of the phase diagram, this becomes much more pronounced. So the important thing here is we have this alternation pattern. So this was coming from here. So this alternation pattern tells us here we have a strict foliation. But here, this means that there is still some remnant of this foliation there. So this means these triangulations are not just completely wild, but these are, as we say here, weakly foliated. One can also make this more precise as we then explain in the articles. So this means as we move downwards, the foliation gets more and more relaxed. But this is what we observe here. Up to this point and further, we cannot go currently. So there is still some kind of a foliation, but it is not as strict as in CDT. Now let's have a look at volume profiles. That was the very important observable in CDT. So in order to define a volume profile, we need two things. One is a time variable, and now we have a proposal for such a time variable. But then we also need spatial slices. So what does this mean in the new model, where these slices, they can branch out? So for example here, so again, the blue links are space-like and the red ones are time-like. So if you have all these small objects here, which we call the bubbles, you can define a lot of spatial slices here. You can go here along the light blue line, and that's a spatial slice. You can also decide here, for example, oh, I will go upstairs instead of downstairs. That's another spatial slice. So in principle, in this model, you can have a great amount of these spatial slices. And since there could be so many of them, we cannot really count all of them in the simulation. So we use a statistical approach to sample a subset of all possible slices. And then we can define a volume profile observable. Now here is an example of a volume profile. So So what we see here on this plot, first of all, the axis. Here is the time axis. And this is the time which I've explained before. This is our method that I have illustrated here. So we calculate here a time, and afterwards we plot this then here in this diagram. Now, this axis here measures the volume of these spatial slices, as I've shown before. The volume in our case, in the 2 plus 1 dimensional case, is simply the number of spatial triangles in each slice. So for every slice that we sample in our triangulation, we measure its time, and this is the average time of all triangles. And we measure the volume, and then we make a point, a dot here in this plot. And then we get this kind of distribution. Now, these you see here, there are these clusters of these dots. And that's precisely if you have something like this here, that you have spatial slices which are very close to each other. You can have here define a spatial slice, then a very similar one, which is a very similar time and a very similar volume. And that's why there's lots of dots here almost at the same location. And then comes a gap, and this gap is nothing else than the gap which you see here between these modified slices. So this structure here also confirms that there is still some sort of foliation, even though it may not be completely a strict foliation like in CDT, but it is an approximate foliation. So here, that is... That's actually a good question. Here, I don't know. I can just say that the volume profiles, they look very similar, actually, independently, whether you have an alpha, for example, close to the phase boundary or not. So in this sense, it is doesn't make much a difference here. No, at minus one, at the isotropic case, it is still of that kind. So if you are in the phase diagram here, you have this kind of distribution, of course, here in the CDT corner. As you move down here, you still have this kind of weakly foliated structure. And the question is, of course, what would happen afterwards? And that I cannot say because we cannot currently explore the rest of the alpha axis. But throughout the region which we have explored, we have always seen this weakly foliated structure. Okay? Yes, that's true. Yeah, eventually one could expect that this would happen if you go further. So this means, of course, if one would look very close, then it could be that this difference here is maybe slightly smaller, but by eye, it's hard to see, actually. So it's still qualitatively, it's the same. So this is a single volume profile drawn from a single triangulation. Now, we want to have an average volume profile calculated of the whole ensemble of triangulation. So the problem is, first, if you just calculate the volume profiles for a bunch of triangulation and just superimpose them, you get something like this. But the problem here is that it's not clear how you have to horizontally align these volume profiles, because this zero here is more or less an arbitrary value. This means we had to deal with the problem of how to align these or how to superimpose these distributions. And we have developed an algorithm to do this, which tries to impose some kind of a best matching algorithm using center of volume. So the result of this algorithm is then shown here, which illustrates that here these volume profiles are aligned much better than they are here. So once we are here, so we then use the method of splines to make a continuous curve, which we can then use to average these volume profiles. So the important result here is the average volume profile shown on the right, which shows that these geometries are macroscopically extended. And they show this typical profile, which we already know pretty well from CDT. So this is now a qualitative assessment, which already shows that this dynamic seems to be very close to CDT. So now let's have a more quantitative look at this. So let's do some finite size scaling. That means what we did was to run another series of simulation with different system sizes. So we have run simulations at sizes between 40,000 tetrahedron and 160,000 tetrahedron. We have calculated the volume profiles for every system size. This is shown here. Now, if you just plot these without doing any rescaling, you get the picture on the left, which is clear that this curve here corresponds to the largest system size, and the blue, the black one corresponds to the smallest system size. So now we can ask whether we can superimpose these curves using finitized scaling. This means we can attempt to rescale the axis, the time axis, and the volume axis, as shown here, in order to overlap these as well as possible. And this depends on the macroscopic Hausdorff dimension. And this is one possibility for us to assess the dimension of these geometries. So we have done this. And this is one example which has also been done, in fact, at the origin, I mean, at the isotropic point here at in the phase diagram. And we have found that a best match for a dimension value which is very close to 3, which is what we had, would hope to find. And in fact, I would like to notice you that here, there are actually 4 curves, not 1. So these are all the 4 curves here, just rescaled. And you can see that the finite size scaling, the overlap, works extremely well. This is a very nice quality. And this overlap is achieved, again, using a value of d of 2.91 in this particular case. So that's made at one point in the phase diagram. So we have repeated that in the whole phase diagram. So the results are shown here in these plots. What we did here is measure the dimension along the k-axis. So here, -1, I can maybe draw some numbers here. So -1, this is, for example, here. This is 0. And here comes somewhere the phase transition. So we have looked at this region here. So we have made a few measurements on this axis. And that's the left plot. And the right plot, we have then done measurements here on this axis. And here another one. What we can see here is that the dimension turns out to be around 3 consistently. There are some differences depending on the quality of the finite size scaling. So these large dots mean that the finite size scaling was working very well, while the small dots, there were more errors. So there where the finite size scaling works very well, the value is very close to 3. So this plot provides very good evidence that these geometries that we observe are in fact three-dimensional, just like in CDT. So we have not included here error bars because we have observed that the systematic errors dominate. So it is not easy to measure these dimensions. But there is, in fact, another observable which gives us also a very good confirmation of what we have found here, that the geometries are, in fact, three-dimensional. So let's have a look at the volume profile. Let's try to fit it with Euclidean Disiter spacetime. So this is the 3-sphere. We have attempted to fit the data. And the simulation data is here shown in red. So the red is, in fact, 4 curves, all the 4 curves superimposed. And in black, this is almost not visible here, is a fit to the cosine to the 2 function, which is the volume profile of the 3-sphere. So one observes an excellent fit of this function. And this is a very, very nice quality, which again confirms that these geometries are three-dimensional. And it also shows us that the volume profile is given by the Euclidean Disiter spacetime, just like in CDT. But this is a very nice result. It's very nice quality. So after having presented this result, let me summarize this talk. So I've introduced here a new model of dynamical triangulations, which uses Lorentzian building blocks, and which does not have a preferred foliation. We have developed a simulation software to measure dynamical properties in 2 plus 1 dimensions. We found that in the phase diagram, there is a region where the triangulations are almost strictly foliated. So one could say that CDT emerges in that region of the phase diagram. We've seen that these geometries in this phase, they are all still show some remnant of a foliation. So this means they are what we call a weakly foliated triangulation. We've also shown strong evidence that these geometries are in fact three-dimensional. And finally, we have also made a fit with a volume profile of the three-sphere, the Euclidean de Sitter space in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and fit that excellent quality. So what can we conclude from this? So we can say that the locally causal dynamical triangulation model in CDT appear to have very similar low-energy behavior in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And of course, one should do other measurements to confirm this result. And there's a good chance that this may even be true in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And also this, of course, has to be confirmed first. If all this is verified, then we could conclude that having this preferred foliation is not strictly necessary. But of course, it is still very convenient, because the CDT simulations are easier to run and also faster, of course. So what are open questions and challenges? So we want to have, of course, we want to measure other observables, for example, the spectral dimension. We want to also have a better handle of systematic errors, because we have introduced many algorithms, like the averaging algorithms for volume profiles. And there it is very hard to estimate the errors. We have also these errors, these problems, which prevent us from exploring part of the phase diagram. And maybe there are Monte Carlo moves, which we haven't seen yet, which we could develop to help us exploring this region. Another challenge is to actually solve the 1 plus 1 model analytically. So that has been done in CDT. We've tried to do it in the new model as well. So this has been done by master students. But they have not yet achieved the goal. So we still haven't been able to solve the 1 plus 1 dimensional model analytically. So if we cannot do it right now analytically, we can maybe do it numerically. And this is an ongoing project in Nijmegen, done by a master student. And finally, we would like to verify the findings in 3 plus 1 dimensions. But the question is, can we do it? Because developing the simulation software in 2 plus 1 dimension was an extreme challenge. So is it possible to do? Maybe, hopefully. So thank you very much.
Are there any more questions?
So you showed this beautiful connection, the correspondence between your volume profile and then the three sphere. So can you compare what the analogous result is for CDT?
Yeah, in CDT we have similar quality.
It's essentially the same.
It's essentially the same. So of course in CDT that's one difference, but it's facing another problem. So we have here, in CDT there is always this stalk which is coming basically from the topological restriction. And this is also in fact a pretty nice feature of this model, that since we use the three-sphere topology and since the time extent is dynamic, so it's not fixed. I mean, in CDT you had this so many number of time steps. And here it can change. And it happens that the time extent even matches. So if you see here the cosine to the 2, if you cut it here at the minimum, it just matches. And this is very nice.
Well, so two things. But first of all, for the 1 plus 1 dimensional model and solvability, I mean, there exists, of course, a 1 plus 1 dimensional model which is much wilder than what you suggest, namely the string bit model by Duhus and Lee, mm-hmm. where you have no time really. You just have a local step forward, and no time is really defined in this way. But nevertheless, it gives, of course, the same continuum limit as the CCT mm-hmm. model. So most likely, it is the same, because there's a much mm-hmm. wilder model which already gives the same. So, the other question, this is a question. So now that we have given up this time foliation, then one could be tempted to ask the following question, since we now get some nice sphere. what profile have you tested, what profile you would get if you just took an arbitrary point in your configuration and then started taking spherical shells with no reference to any time direction or anything, and just measure the spherical shells, you will get some distribution.
Yeah, the Hausdorff dimension profile, you say. I mean, that's basically the basis for the Hausdorff dimension measurement.
So is it a cosine squared?
So I haven't done a precise measurement of this. So that's basically to do measuring Hausdorff and spectral dimension and also look at these distributions. So I cannot right now comment on this. So we have also, of course, looked at this in 1 plus 1 dimensions. But for now, we have not strict the results for this.
OK.
Yeah.
Can you say anything on the question of the results on the spectral dimension will be somewhat influenced by this giving up of the bird foliation?
Yeah, so that's also to do, the spectral dimension. So I have quickly looked at it, and in general, it looked okay, but the quality was just not so nice.
So by looking okay, you mean it also goes to...
Yeah, so approximately 3, but it was just not, it was a bit, the quality was just not so nice. But qualitatively, it was okay.
But you see the same scale dependence, that's what you...
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, yes.
So not just the infrared value, but also the...
It was a similar curve as the one
sensitivity.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the measure that you use in your particle world. Your calculations, you're doing Monte Carlo simulations,
mm-hmm.
you're picking up a triangulation and summing over there.
Yes.
And well, that uses a measure of your.
Basically, it's every triangulation counted once. But there are sometimes the triangulation can be symmetric, and then there's a factor compensating for it.
But for this Lorentzian case, you have a bunch of triangulations that wouldn't be allowed, and you, how does it work? You take all of them, you select away those that aren't allowed, and the other ones can't.
What do you mean with aren't allowed?
Because you have a selection rule for the...
Yeah, the condition. So these, yeah, they do not appear.
I think you produce the correct triangulation.
These conditions are, of course, enforced.
Enforced, yeah.
Well, kinematically, yes. This is, well, the software is designed such a way that it's impossible to violate.
Okay. Yeah, but that general, that tends to induce some measure on some bias on the choice. Of, no? I don't know. I was just
imagining
how we do this.
Yeah, cannot comment on this.
Okay, any further questions?
Sure. Can you explain what the CT measure factor is? Is it easy to explain?
Yeah, let's go back. Yeah, it's this factor here. It's 1/CT. So it's mostly 1, but it's sometimes if a triangulation has a symmetry, then there's this automorphism group. And this is basically the value which then goes into here, so it's a compensating factor. In practice, it's there's a conspiracy which makes sure that when you program a Monte Carlo simulation, that you just don't have to do anything, and then it comes out that way. So that's why we usually do not think about much about it. But this has been, of course, analyzed strictly.
Well, it's automatically implemented when you do Monte Carlo simulation.
Yeah.
So you're summing over automorphism groups? No.
Because this is written for unlabeled triangulations, abstract triangulations.
Okay.
But when you work in a computer, you have labeled triangulations.
Okay.
It's good. And because of that, automatically this factor is can reproduce by treating each labeled triangulation with weight 1, or 1/n, where n is the number of vertices and so on. So it's automatically included. So the interesting thing, the nice thing is that this is really what we want, of course. But by working with labeled triangulations, we automatically implement this factor, which would be almost impossible to calculate.
I see.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's nevertheless almost always 1.
Yes,
that's also true.
Okay, so I would suggest that we have further discussions over cookies, which we have thanks to Bianca, and let's thank Samuel again for his talk.